Side 4.
What's this? He suddenly realized she had been talking to him and he hadn't noticed. Or rather, he had not recognized her voice. Instead of the usual tone of voice in which she spoke to him, which was bitter and truculent, she was just asking him a simple question. He looked round in surprise. She was sitting there on a stool in the corner of the hut, in that rather hunched way she had, knees together, feet splayed out, with her dark hair hanging down over her face, as she looked at something she had cradled in her hands. Arthur went over to her, a little nervously. Her mood swings were very unpredictable, but so far they'd all been between different types of bad ones. Outbreaks of bitter recrimination would give way without warning to abject self-pity, and then long bouts of sullen despair, which were punctuated with sudden acts of mindless violence against inanimate objects and demands to go to electric clubs. Not only were there no electric clubs on Lamuella, there were no clubs at all, and in fact no electricity. There was a forge and a bakery, a few carts and a well, but those were the high watermark of Lamuellan technology, and a fair number of Random's unquenchable rages were directed against the sheer incomprehensible backwardness of the place. She could pick up the sub-ether TV on a small flexor panel which had been surgically implanted in her wrist, but that didn't cheer her up at all because it was full of news of insanely exciting things happening in every other part of the galaxy than here. It would also give her frequent news of her mother, who had dumped her to go off and cover some war which now seemed not to have happened, or at least to have gone all wrong in some way because of the absence of any proper intelligence gathering. It also gave her access to lots of great adventure shows featuring all kinds of fantastically expensive spaceships crashing into each other. The villagers were absolutely hypnotized by all these wonderful magic images flashing over her wrist. They had only ever seen one spaceship crash, and it had been so frightening, violent and shocking, and had caused so much horrible devastation, fire and death, that, stupidly, they'd never realized it was entertainment. Old Thrashbark had been so astonished by it that he had instantly seen Random as an emissary from Bob, but had fairly soon afterwards decided that, in fact, she'd been sent as a test of his faith, if not of his patience. He was also alarmed at the number of spaceship crashes he had to start incorporating into his holy stories if he was to hold the attention of the villagers, and not have them rushing off to peer at Random's wrist all the time. At the moment, she was not peering at her wrist. Her wrist was turned off. Arthur squatted down quietly beside her to see what she was looking at. It was his watch. He had taken it off when he'd gone to shower under the local waterfall, and Random had found it and was trying to work it out. "It's just a watch," he said. "It's to tell the time." "I know that," she said, "but you keep on fiddling with it, and it still doesn't tell the right time, or even anything like it." She brought up the display on her wrist panel, which automatically produced a readout of local time. Her wrist panel had quietly got on with the business of measuring the local gravity and orbital momentum, and had noticed where the sun was and tracked its movement in the sky all within the first few minutes of Random's arrival. It had then quickly picked up clues from its environment as to what the local unit conventions were and reset itself appropriately. It did this sort of thing continually, which was particularly valuable if you did a lot of travelling in time as well as space. Random frowned at her father's watch, which didn't do any of this. Arthur was very fond of it. It was a better one than he would ever have afforded himself. He had been given it on his 22nd birthday, by a rich and guilt-ridden godfather who had forgotten every single birthday he had had up till then, and also his name. It had the day, the date, the phases of the moon. It had "to Albert" on his 21st birthday, and the wrong date engraved on the battered and scratched surface of its back, in letters that were still just about visible. The watch had been through a considerable amount of stuff in the last few years, most of which would fall well outside the warranty. He didn't suppose, of course, that the gravity had especially mentioned that the watch was guaranteed to be accurate only within the very particular gravitational and magnetic fields of the Earth, and so long as the day was 24 hours long and the planet didn't explode, and so on. These were such basic assumptions that even the lawyers would have missed them. Luckily, his watch was a wind-up one, or at least a self-winder. Nowhere else in the galaxy would he have found batteries of precisely the dimensions and power specifications that were perfectly standard on Earth. "So what are all these numbers?" asked Random. Arthur took it from her. "These numbers around the edge mark the hours. In the little window on the right it says THU, which means Thursday, and the number is 14, which means it's the 14th day of the month of May, which is what it says in this window over here. And this sort of crescent-shaped window at the top tells you about the phases of the moon. In other words, it tells you how much of the moon is lit up at night by the sun, which depends on the relative positions of the sun and the moon and, well, the Earth. The Earth, said Random. Yes. And that's where you came from and where Mum came from. Yes, said Arthur. Random took the watch back from him and looked at it again, clearly baffled by something. Then she held it up to her ear and listened in puzzlement. What's that noise? It's ticking, said Arthur. That's the mechanism that drives the watch. It's called clockwork. It's all kind of interlocking cogs and springs that work to turn the hands round at exactly the right speed to mark the hours, minutes and days and so on. Random carried on peering at it. There's something puzzling you, said Arthur. What is it? Yes, said Random at last. Why is it all in hardware? Arthur suggested they went for a walk. He felt there were things they should discuss, and for once Random seemed, if not precisely amenable and willing, then at least not growling. From Random's point of view, this is also all very weird. It wasn't that she wanted to be difficult as such. It was just that she didn't know how or what else to be. Who was this guy? What was this life she was supposed to lead? What was this world she was supposed to lead it in? And what was this universe that kept coming at her through her eyes and ears? What was it for? What did it want? She'd been born in a spaceship that had been going from somewhere to somewhere else. And when it had got to somewhere else had turned out to be only another somewhere that you had to go to somewhere else again from, and so on. It was her normal expectation that she was supposed to be somewhere else. It was normal for her to feel that she was in the wrong place. Then, constant time travel had only compounded this problem, and had led to the feeling that she was not only always in the wrong place, but she was also almost always there at the wrong time. She didn't notice that she felt this, because it was the only way she ever felt. Just as it never seemed odd to her that nearly everywhere she went she needed to wear either weights or anti-gravity suits, and usually special apparatus for breathing as well. The only places you could ever feel right were the worlds you designed for yourself to inhabit, virtual realities in the electric clubs. It had never occurred to her that the real universe was something you could actually fit into. And that included this Lamuella place her mother had dumped her in. And it also included this person who had bestowed on her this precious and magical gift of life in return for a seat upgrade. It was just as well he turned out to be rather kind and friendly, or there would have been trouble, really. She'd got a specially sharpened stone in her pocket she could cause a lot of trouble with. It can be very dangerous to see things from somebody else's point of view without the proper training. They sat on the spot that Arthur particularly liked, on the side of a hill overlooking the valley. The sun was going down over the village. The only thing that Arthur wasn't quite so fond of was being able to see a little way into the next valley, where a deep, dark, mangled furrow in the forest marked the spot where his ship had crashed. But maybe that was what kept bringing him back here. There were plenty of spots from which you could survey the lush, rolling countryside of Lamuella, but this was the one he was drawn to, with its nagging, dark spot of fear and pain nestling just on the edge of his vision. He had never been there again since he had been pulled out of the wreckage. Wouldn't, couldn't bear it. Well, in fact, he had gone some of the way back to it the very next day, while he was still numb and spinning with shock. He had a broken leg, a couple of broken ribs, some bad burns, and was not really thinking coherently, but had insisted that the villagers take him, which uneasily they had. He had not managed to get right to the actual spot where the ground had bubbled and melted, however, and had at last hobbled away from the horror forever. Soon, word had got around that the whole area was haunted, and no one had ventured back there ever since. The land was full of beautiful, verdant and delightful valleys, no point in going to a highly worrying one. Let the past hold on to itself, and let the present move forward into the future. Random cradled the watch in her hands, slowly turning it to let the long light of the evening sun shine warmly in the scratches and scuffs of the thick glass. It fascinated her watching the spidery little second hand ticking its way round. Every time it completed a full circle, the longer of the two main hands had moved on exactly to the next of the 60 small divisions round the dial. And when the long hand had made its own full circle, the smaller hand had moved on to the next of the main digits. "You've been watching it for over an hour," said Arthur quietly. "I know," she said. "An hour is when the big hand has gone all the way round, yes?" "That's right." "Then I've been watching it for an hour and 17 minutes?" She smiled with a deep and mysterious pleasure, and moved very slightly so that she was resting just a little against his arm. Arthur felt that a small sigh escaped from him that had been pent up inside his chest for weeks. He wanted to put his arm around his daughter's shoulders, but felt it was too early yet and that she would shy away from him. But something was working, something was easing inside her. The watch meant something to her that nothing in her life so far had managed to do. Arthur was not sure that he had really understood what it was yet, but he was profoundly pleased and relieved that something had reached her. "Explain to me again," said Random. "There's nothing really to it," said Arthur. "Clockwork was something that developed over hundreds of years." "Earth years," said Random. "Yes. It became finer and finer and more intricate. It was highly skilled and delicate work. It had to be made very small and had to carry on working accurately however much you waved it around or dropped it." "But only on one planet," said Random. "Well, that was where it was made, you see," said Arthur. "It was never expected to go anywhere else and deal with different suns and moons and magnetic fields and things. I mean, the thing still goes perfectly well, but doesn't really mean much this far from Switzerland."
"From where?"
"Switzerland, that's where these things were made. Small, hilly country, tiresomely neat. The people who made them didn't really know there were other worlds."
"Quite a big thing not to know," said Random.
"Well, yes," said Arthur.
"So where did they come from?"
"Well, they, that is, we just sort of grew there. We evolved on the Earth," said Arthur, "from, I don't know, some kind of sludge or something."
"Like this watch," said Random.
"Well, I don't think the watch grew out of sludge," said Arthur. "You don't understand!" Random suddenly leapt to her feet, shouting, "You don't understand! You don't understand me! You don't understand anything! I hate you for being so stupid!" She started to run hectically down the hill, still clutching the watch and shouting that she hated him. Arthur jumped up, startled and at a loss. He started to run down after her through the stringy and clumpy grass. It was hard and painful for him. When he had broken his leg in the crash, it had not been a clean break, and it had not healed cleanly. He was stumbling and wincing as he ran. Suddenly she turned and faced him, her face dark with anger. She brandished the watch at him. "You don't understand that there's somewhere this belongs? Somewhere it works? Somewhere that it fits?" She turned and ran again. She was fit and fleet-footed, and Arthur could not remotely keep up with her. It wasn't that he had not expected being a father to be this difficult, it was that he hadn't expected to be a father at all, particularly not suddenly and unexpectedly, on an alien planet. Random turned to shout at him again. For some reason he stopped each time she did. "Who do you think I am?" she demanded angrily. "Your upgrade? Who do you think Mum thought I was? Some sort of ticket to the life she didn't have?"
"I don't know what you mean by that," said Arthur, panting and hurting.
"You don't know what anybody means by anything!"
"What do you mean?"
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!"
"Tell me, please tell me," said Arthur. "What do you mean by saying the life she didn't have?"
"She wished she'd stayed on Earth. She wished she hadn't gone off with that stupid brain-dead fruit gum Zaphod. She thinks she would have had a different life."
"But," said Arthur, "she would have been killed. She would have been killed when the world was destroyed."
"Well, that's a different life, isn't it?"
"Well, that's...
She wouldn't have had to have me. She hates me."
You can't mean that. How could anyone possibly,
she had me because I was meant to make things fit for her. That was my job. But I fitted even worse than she did. So she just shut me off and carried on with her stupid life."
"What's stupid about her life?" insisted Arthur. "She's fantastically successful, isn't she? She's all over time and space, all over the sub-ether TV networks."
"Stupid! Stupid! Stupid! Stupid!" Random turned and ran off again. Arthur couldn't keep up with her, and at last he had to sit down for a bit and let the pain in his leg subside. The turmoil in his head, he didn't know what to do with at all. He hobbled into the village an hour later. It was getting dark. The villagers he passed said hello, but there was a sense of nervousness and of not quite knowing what was going on or what to do about it in the air. Old Thrashbark had been pulling on his beard a fair bit and looking at the moon, and that was not a good sign either. Arthur went into his hut. Random was sitting hunched quietly over the table.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry."
"That's all right," said Arthur, as gently as he knew how. "It's good to, well, to have a little chat. There's so much we have to learn and understand about each other, and life isn't, well, it isn't all just tea and sandwiches."
"I'm so sorry," she said again, sobbing.
Arthur went up to her and put his arm around her shoulder. She didn't resist or pull away. Then Arthur saw what it was she was so sorry about. In the pool of light thrown by a Lamuellan lantern lay Arthur's watch. Random had forced the back off it with the back edge of the butter-spreading knife, and all of the minute cogs and springs and levers were lying in a tiny cockeyed mess where she'd been fiddling with them.
"I just wanted to see how it worked," said Random, "how it all fitted together. I'm so sorry I can't get it back together. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I don't know what to do. I'll get it repaired, really, I'll get it repaired."
The following day, Thrashbarg came around and said all sorts of bob stuff. He tried to exert a calming influence by inviting Random to let her mind dwell on the ineffable mystery of the giant earwig, and Random said there was no giant earwig, and Thrashbarg went very cold and silent, and said she would be cast into the outer darkness. Random said good, she had been born there. And the next day, the parcel arrived. This was all getting a bit eventful. In fact, when the parcel arrived, delivered by a kind of robot drone that dropped out of the sky making droning robot noises, it brought with it a sense which gradually began to permeate through the whole village, that it was almost one event too many. It wasn't the robot drone's fault. All it required was Arthur Dent's signature or thumbprint or just a few scrapings of skin cells from the nape of his neck, and it would be on its way again. It hung around, waiting, not quite sure what all this resentment about. Meanwhile, Kerb had caught another fish with a head at both ends, but on closer inspection it turned out that it was in fact two fish cut in half and sewn together rather badly. So not only had Kerb failed to rekindle any great interest in two-headed fish, he had also seriously cast doubt on the authenticity of the first one. Only the picker birds seemed to feel that everything was exactly normal. The robot drone got Arthur's signature and made its escape. Arthur bore the parcel back to his hut and sat and looked at it.
"Let's open it," said Random,
who was feeling much more cheerful this morning, now that everything around her had got thoroughly weird. But Arthur said no.
"Why not? It's not addressed to me."
"Yes, it is."
"No, it isn't. It's addressed to... well, it's addressed to Ford Prefect, in care of me."
"Ford Prefect? Isn't he the one who..."
"Yes," said Arthur tartly.
"I've heard about him."
"I expect you have."
"Well, let's open it anyway. What else are we going to do?"
"I don't know," said Arthur, who really wasn't sure.
He had taken his damaged knives over to the forge bright and early that morning, and Strinder had had a look at them and said that he would see what he could do. They had tried the usual business of waving the knives through the air, feeling for the point of balance and the point of flex and so on, but the joy was gone from it, and Arthur had a sad feeling that his sandwich-making days were probably numbered. He hung his head. The next appearance of the perfectly normal beast was imminent. But Arthur felt that the usual festivities of hunting and feasting were going to be rather muted and uncertain. Something had happened here on Lamuella, and Arthur had a horrible feeling that it was him.
"What do you think it is?" urged Random, turning the parcel over in her hands.
"I don't know," said Arthur. "Something bad and worrying, though."
"How do you know?" Random protested.
"Because anything that's to do with Ford Prefect is bound to be worse and more worrying than something that isn't," said Arthur. "Believe me."
"You're upset about something, aren't you?" said Random.
Arthur sighed.
"I'm just feeling a little jumpy and unsettled, I think," said Arthur.
"I'm sorry," said Random, and put the package down again. She could see that it would really upset him if she opened it. She would just have to do it when he wasn't looking.
Chapter 16. Arthur wasn't quite certain which he noticed as being missing first. When he noticed that the one wasn't there, his mind instantly leapt to the other, and he knew immediately that they were both gone, and that something insanely bad and difficult to deal with would happen as a result. Random was not there, and neither was the parcel. He had left it up on a shelf all day in plain view. It was an exercise in trust. He knew that one of the things he was supposed to do as a parent was to show trust in his child, to build a sense of trust and confidence into the bedrock of the relationship between them. He had had a nasty feeling that that might turn out to be an idiotic thing to do, but he did it anyway, and sure enough, it had turned out to be an idiotic thing to do. You live and learn. At any rate, you live. You also panic. Arthur ran out of the hut. It was the middle of the evening. The light was getting dim, and a storm was brewing. He could not see her anywhere, nor any sign of her. He asked. No one had seen her. He asked again. No one else had seen her. They were going home for the night.
A little wind was whipping round the edge of the village, picking things up and tossing them around in a dangerously casual manner. He found old Thrashbarg and asked him. Thrashbarg looked at him stonily, and then pointed in the one direction that Arthur had dreaded, and had therefore instinctively known was the way she would have gone. So now he knew the worst. She had gone where she thought he would not follow her. He looked up at the sky, which was sullen, streaked, and livid, and reflected that it was the sort of sky that the four horsemen of the apocalypse wouldn't feel like a bunch of complete idiots riding out of. With a heavy sense of the utmost foreboding, he set off on the track that led to the forest in the next valley. The first heavy blobs of rain began to hit the ground as Arthur tried to drag himself to some sort of run. Random reached the crest of the hill and looked down into the next valley. It had been a longer and harder climb than she had anticipated. She was a little worried that doing the trip at night was not that great an idea, but her father had been mooching around near the hut all day, trying to pretend to either her or himself that he wasn't guarding the parcel. At last he'd had to go over to the forge to talk with Strinder about the knives, and Random had seized her opportunity and done a runner with the parcel. It was perfectly clear that she couldn't just open the thing there in the hut or even in the village. He might have come across her at any moment, which meant that she had to go where she wouldn't be followed. She could stop where she was now. She'd gone this way in the hope that he wouldn't follow her, and even if he did, he would never find her up in the wooded parts of the hill with the night drawing in and the rain starting. All the way up, the parcel had been jiggling under her arm. It was a satisfyingly hunky sort of thing, a box with a square top about the length of her forearm on each side and about the length of her hand deep, wrapped up in brown plasper, with an ingenious new form of self-knotting string. It didn't rattle as she shook it, but she sensed that its weight was concentrated excitingly at the centre. Having come so far, though, there was a certain satisfaction in not stopping here, but carrying on down into what seemed to be almost a forbidden area, where her father's ship had come down. She wasn't exactly certain what the word haunted meant, but it might be fun to find out. She would keep going and save the parcel up when she got there. It was getting darker, though. She hadn't used her tiny electric torch yet, because she didn't want to be visible from a distance. She would have to use it now, but it probably didn't matter now, since she would be on the other side of the hill which divided the valleys from each other. She turned her torch on. Almost at the same time, a fork of lightning ripped across the valley into which she was heading and startled her considerably. As the darkness shuddered back around her and a clap of thunder rolled out across the land, she felt suddenly rather small and lost, with just a feeble pencil of light bobbing in her hand. Perhaps she would stop after all and open the parcel here, or maybe she should go back and come out again tomorrow. It was only a momentary hesitation, though. She knew there was no going back tonight, and sensed that there was no going back ever. She headed on down the side of the hill. The rain was beginning to pick up now. Where a short while ago it had been a few heavy blobs, it was settling in for a good pour now, hissing in the trees, and the ground was getting slippery under her feet. At least she thought it was the rain hissing in the trees. Shadows were leaping and leering at her as her light bobbed through the trees, onwards and downwards. She hurried on for another 10 or 15 minutes, soaked to the skin now and shivering, and gradually became aware that there seemed to be some other light somewhere ahead of her. It was very faint, and she wasn't certain if she was imagining it or not. She turned off her torch to see. There did seem to be some sort of dim glow ahead. She couldn't tell what it was. She turned her torch back on and continued down the hill towards whatever it was. There was something wrong with the woods, though. She couldn't immediately say what it was, but they didn't seem like sprightly, healthy woods looking forward to a good spring. The trees were lolling at sickly angles and had a sort of pallid, blighted look about them. Random more than once had the worrying sensation that they were trying to reach towards her as she passed them, but it was just a trick of the way that her light caused the shadows to flicker and lurch. Suddenly, something fell out of a tree in front of her. She leapt backwards with alarm, dropping both the torch and the box as she did so. She went down into a crouch, pulling the specially sharpened rock out of her pocket. The thing that had fallen out of the tree was moving. The torch was lying on the ground and pointing towards it, and a vast, grotesque shadow was slowly lurching through the light towards her. She could hear faint rustling and screeching noises over the steady hiss of the rain. She scrabbled on the ground for the torch, found it, and shone it directly at the creature. At the same moment, another dropped from a tree just a few feet away. She swung the torch wildly from one to another. She held her rock up, ready to throw. They were quite small, in fact, It was the angle of the light that had made them loom so large. Not only small, but small, furry, and cuddly. And there was another dropping from the trees. It fell through the beam of light so that she saw it quite clearly. It fell neatly and precisely, turned, and then, like the other two, started slowly and purposefully to advance on random. She stayed rooted to the spot. She still had her rock poised and ready to throw, but was increasingly conscious of the fact that the things she had it poised and ready to throw at were squirrels. Oh, or at least squirrel-like things. Soft, warm, cuddly, squirrel-like things, advancing on her in a way she wasn't at all certain she liked. She shone her torch directly on the first of them. It was making aggressive, hectoring, screeching noises, and carrying in one of its little fists a small, tattered piece of wet pink rag. Random hefted her rock menacingly in her hand, but it made no impression at all on the squirrel advancing on her with its wet piece of rag. She backed away. She didn't at all know how to deal with this. If they had been vicious, snarling, slavering beasts with glistening fangs, she would have pitched into them with a will, but squirrels behaving like this she couldn't quite handle. She backed away again. The second squirrel was starting to make a flanking manoeuvre round to her right, carrying a cup, some kind of acorn thing. The third was right behind it and making its own advance. What was it carrying? Some little scrap of soggy paper, Random thought. She stepped back again, caught her ankle against the root of a tree, and fell over backwards. Instantly, the first squirrel darted forward and was on top of her, advancing along her stomach with cold purpose in its eyes and a piece of wet rag in its fist. Random tried to jump up, but only managed to jump about an inch. The startled movement of the squirrel on her stomach startled her in return. The squirrel froze, gripping her skin through her soaking shirt with its tiny claws. Then, slowly, inch by inch, it made its way up her, stopped, and proffered her the rag. She felt almost hypnotized by the strangeness of the thing and its tiny, glinting eyes. It proffered her the rag again. It pushed it at her repeatedly, screeching insistently, till at last, nervously, hesitantly, she took the thing from it. It continued to watch her intently, its eyes darting all over her face. She had no idea what to do. Rain and mud were streaming down her face, and she had a squirrel sitting on her. She wiped some mud out of her eyes with the rag. The squirrel shrieked triumphantly, grabbed the rag back, leapt off her, ran scampering into the dark and closing night, darted up into a tree, dived into a hole in the trunk, settled back, and lit a cigarette. Meanwhile, Random was trying to fend off the squirrel with the acorn cup full of rain, and the one with the paper. She shuffled backwards on her bottom. "No," she shouted, "go away!" They darted back in fright, and then darted right forward again with their gifts. She brandished her rock at them. "Go!" she yelled. The squirrels scampered round in consternation. Then one darted straight at her, dropped the acorn cup in her lap, turned and ran off into the night. The other stood quivering for a moment, then put its scrap of paper neatly down in front of her, and disappeared as well. She was alone again, but trembling with confusion. She got unsteadily to her feet, picked up her rock and her parcel, then paused and picked up the scrap of paper as well. It was so soggy and dilapidated, it was hard to make out what it was. It seemed just to be a fragment of an in-flight magazine. Just as Random was trying to understand exactly what it was that all this meant, a man walked out into the clearing in which she was standing, raised a vicious-looking gun, and shot her. Arthur was thrashing around hopelessly 2 or 3 miles behind her, on the upward side of the hill. Within minutes of setting out, he'd gone back again and equipped himself with a lamp, not an electric one. The only electric light in the place was the one that Random had brought with her. This was a kind of dim hurricane lamp, a perforated metal canister from Strinder's forge, which contained a reservoir of inflammable fish oil, a wick of knotted dried grass, and was wrapped in a translucent film made from the dried membranes from the gut of a perfectly normal beast. It had now gone out. Arthur jiggled around with it in a thoroughly pointless kind of a way for a few seconds. There was clearly no way he was going to get the thing suddenly to burst into flame again in the middle of a rainstorm, but it's impossible not to make a token effort. Reluctantly, he threw the thing aside. What to do? This was hopeless. He was absolutely sodden, his clothes heavy and billowing with the rain, and now he was lost in the dark as well. For a brief second, he was lost in the blinding light. Then he was lost in the dark again. The sheet of lightning had at least shown him that he was very close to the brow of the hill. Once he'd breasted that, he would... Well, he wasn't certain what he'd do. He'd have to work that out when he got there. He limped forward and upwards. A few minutes later, he knew that he was standing panting at the top. There was some kind of dim glow in the distance below him. He had no idea what it was, and indeed he hardly liked to think. It was the only thing he had to make towards, though, so he started to make his way, stumbling, lost and frightened, towards it. The flash of lethal light passed straight through Random, and about 2 seconds later, so did the man who had shot it. Other than that, he paid her no attention whatsoever. He had shot someone standing behind her, and when she turned to look, he was kneeling over the body and going through its pockets. The tableau froze and vanished. It was replaced a second later by a giant pair of teeth, framed by immense and perfectly glossed red lips. A huge blue brush appeared out of nowhere and started foamily to scrub at the teeth, which continued to hang there, gleaming in the shimmering curtain of rain. Random blinked at it twice before she got it. It was a commercial. The guy who'd shot her was part of a holographic in-flight movie. She must now be very close to where the ship had crashed. Obviously, some of its systems were more indestructible than others. The next half mile of the journey was particularly troublesome. Not only did she have the cold and the rain and the night to contend with, but also the fractured and thrashing remains of the ship's onboard entertainment system. Spaceships and jet cars and helipods crashed and exploded continuously around her, illuminating the night. Villainous people in strange hats smuggled dangerous drugs through her, and the combined orchestra and chorus of the Halopolis State Opera performed the closing March of the Androquantine Star Guard from Act 4 of Risgar's Blamwellimum of Wundt in a little glade somewhere off to her left. Then she was standing on the lip of a very nasty-looking and bubbly-edged crater. There was still a faint, warm glow coming from what would otherwise have looked like an enormous piece of caramelized chewing gum in the center of the pit. The melted remains of a great spaceship. She stood looking at it for a longish while, and then at last started to walk along and round the edge of the crater. She was no longer certain what she was looking for, but kept moving anyway, keeping the horror of the pit to her left. The rain was beginning to ease off a little, but it was still extremely wet, and since she didn't know what it was that was in the box, whether it was perhaps something delicate or damageable, she thought she ought to find somewhere reasonably dry to open it. She hoped she hadn't already damaged it by dropping it. She played her torch around the surrounding trees, which were thin on the ground here and mostly charred and broken. In the middle distance, she thought she could see a jumbled outcrop of rock, which might provide some shelter, and she started to pick her way towards it. All around she found the detritus that had been ejected from the ship as it broke up before the final fireball. After she had moved 200 or 300 yards from the edge of the crater, she came across the tattered fragments of some fluffy pink material, sodden, mudded, and drooping amongst the broken trees. She guessed correctly that this must be the remains of the escape cocoon which had saved her father's life. She went and looked at it more closely, and then noticed something else close to it on the ground, half covered in mud. She picked it up and wiped the mud off it. It was some kind of electronic device the size of a small book. Feebly glowing on its cover, in response to her touch, were some large friendly letters. They said, "Don't panic." She knew what this was. It was her father's copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. She felt instantly reassured by it, turned her head up to the thundery sky, and let some rain wash over her face and into her mouth. She shook her head and hurried on towards the rocks. Clambering up and over them, she almost immediately found the perfect thing. The mouth of a cave. She played her torch into its interior. It seemed to be dry and safe. Picking her way carefully, she walked in. It was quite spacious, but didn't go that deep. Exhausted and relieved, she sat on a convenient rock, put the box down in front of her, and started immediately to open it. Chapter 17. For a long period of time, there was much speculation and controversy about where the so-called missing matter of the universe had got to. All over the galaxy, the science departments of all the major universities were acquiring more and more elaborate equipment to probe and search the hearts of distant galaxies, and then the very center and the very edges of the whole universe. But when eventually it was tracked down, it turned out, in fact, to be all the stuff which the equipment had been packed in. There was quite a large quantity of missing matter in the box, little soft round pellets of missing matter, which Random discarded for future generations of physicists to track down and discover all over again, once the findings of the current generation of physicists had been lost and forgotten about. Out of the pellets of missing matter, she lifted the featureless black disk. She put it down on a rock beside her and sifted amongst all the missing matter to see if there was anything else, a manual or some attachments or something. But there was nothing else at all, just the black disk. She shone the torch on it. As she did so, cracks began to appear along its apparently featureless surface. Random backed away nervously, but then saw that the thing, whatever it was merely unfolding itself. The process was wonderfully beautiful. It was extraordinarily elaborate, but also simple and elegant. It was like a piece of self-opening origami, or a rosebud blooming into a rose in just a few seconds. Where, just a few moments earlier, there had been a smoothly curved black disk, there was now a bird hovering there. Random continued to back away from it carefully and watchfully. It was a little like a picker bird, only rather smaller, that is to say, in fact, it was larger, or to be more exact, precisely the same size, or at least not less than twice the size. It was also both a lot bluer and a lot pinker than picker birds, while at the same time being perfectly black. There was also something very odd about it, which Random couldn't immediately make out. It certainly shared with picker birds the impression it gave that it was watching something that you couldn't see. Suddenly it vanished. Then, just as suddenly, everything went black. Random dropped into a tense crouch, feeling for the specially sharpened rock in her pocket again. Then the blackness receded and rolled itself up into a ball, and then the blackness was the bird again. It hung in the air in front of her, beating its wings slowly and staring at her. "Excuse me," it said suddenly, "I just have to calibrate myself. Can you hear me when I say this?" "When you say what?" demanded Random. "Good," said the bird. "And can you hear me when I say this?" It spoke this time at a much higher pitch. "Yes, of course I can," said Random. "And can you hear me when I say this?" it said, this time in a sepulchrally deep voice. "Yes!" Then there was a pause. "No, obviously not," said the bird after a few seconds. "Good, well, your hearing range is obviously between 16 and 20 kilohertz." "So, is this comfortable for you?" it said in a pleasant light tenor. "No uncomfortable harmonics screeching away in the upper register?" "Obviously not. Good, I can use those as data channels. Now, how many of me can you see?" Suddenly the air was full of nothing but interlocking birds. Random was well used to spending time in virtual realities, but this was something far weirder than anything she had previously encountered. It was as if the whole geometry of space was redefined in seamless bird shapes. Random gasped and flung her arms around her face, her arms moving through bird-shaped space. "Obviously way too many," said the bird. "How about now?" It concertinaed into a tunnel of birds, as if it was a bird caught between parallel mirrors, reflecting infinitely into the distance. "What are you?" shouted Random. "We'll come to that in a minute," said the bird. "Just how many, please?" "Well, you're sort of..." Random gestured helplessly off into the distance. "I see, still infinite in extent, but at least we're homing in on the right dimensional matrix. Good. No, the answer is an orange and two lemons."
"Lemons?" said Random.
"If I have three lemons and three oranges, and I lose two oranges and a lemon, what do I have left?"
"Huh?"
"Okay, so you think that time flows that way, do you? Interesting. Am I still infinite?" it asked, ballooning this way and that in space. "Am I infinite now? How yellow am I?" Moment by moment, the bird was going through mind-mangling transformations of shape and extent.
"I can't,"
said Random, bewildered. "You don't have to answer. I can tell from watching you now. So, am I your mother? Am I a rock? Do I seem huge, squishy, and sinuously intertwined? No? How about now? Am I going backwards?" For once, the bird was perfectly still and steady. "No," said Random. "Well, I was, in fact, but I was moving backwards in time. Well, I think we've sorted all that out now. If you'd like to know, I can tell you that in your universe, you move freely in three dimensions that you call space. You move in a straight line in a fourth, which you call time, and stay rooted to one place in a fifth, which is the first fundamental of probability. After that, it gets a bit complicated, and there's all sorts of stuff going on in dimensions 13 to 22 that you really wouldn't want to know about. All you really need to know for the moment is that the universe is a lot more complicated than you might think, even if you start from a position of thinking it's pretty damn complicated in the first place. I can easily not say words like damn if it offends you."
"Say what you damn well like," said Random.
"I will." "What the hell are you?" demanded Random. "I am the guide. In your universe, I am your guide. In fact, I inhabit what is technically known as the whole sort of general mishmash, which means, well, let me show you. It turned in midair and swooped out of the cave, and then perched on a rock, just beneath an overhang, out of the rain, which was getting heavier again. Come on, it said, watch this. Random didn't like being bossed around by a bird, but she followed it to the mouth of the cave anyway, still fingering the rock in her pocket. Rain, said the bird. You see, just rain. I know what rain is, said Random. Sheets of the stuff were sweeping through the night, moonlight sifting through it. So what is it?
What do you mean, what is it? Look, who are you? What were you doing in that box? Why have I spent a night running through the forest, fending off demented squirrels, to find that all I've got at the end is a bird asking me what rain is? It's just water falling through the bloody air, that's what it is. Anything else you want to know, or can we go home now?
There was a long pause before the bird answered, You want to go home?
I haven't got a home!
Random almost shocked herself, she screamed the word so loudly. Look into the rain, said the bird guide.
I'm looking into the rain. What else is there to look at?
What do you see?
What do you mean, you stupid bird? I just see a lot of rain. It's just water falling.
What shapes do you see in the water?
Shapes? There aren't any shapes. It's just
a mishmash, said the bird guide.
Yes.
Now what do you see? Just on the very edge of visibility, a thin, faint beam fanned out of the bird's eyes. In the dry air beneath the overhang, there was nothing to see. Where the beam hit the drops of water as they fell through it, there was a flat sheet of light, so bright and vivid it seemed solid.
Oh, great, a laser show, said Random fractiously. Never seen one of those before, of course, except at about 5 million rock concerts. Tell me what you see. Just a flat sheet, stupid bird.
There's nothing there that wasn't there before. I'm just using light to draw your attention to certain drops at certain moments. Now what do you see? The light shut off. Nothing. I'm doing exactly the same thing, but with ultraviolet light, you can't see it.
So what's the point of showing me something I can't see?
So that you understand that just because you see something doesn't mean to say it's there, and if you don't see something, it doesn't mean to say it's not there. It's only what your senses bring to your attention.
I'm bored of this, said Random,
and then gasped. Hanging in the rain was a giant and very vivid three-dimensional image of her father, looking startled about something. About 2 miles behind Random, her father, struggling his way through the woods, suddenly stopped. He was startled to see an image of himself looking startled about something, hanging brightly in the rain-filled air about 2 miles away. About 2 miles away, some distance to the right of the direction in which he was heading. He was almost completely lost, was convinced he was going to die of cold and wet and exhaustion, and was beginning to wish he could just get on with it. He had just been brought an entire golfing magazine by a squirrel as well, and his brain was beginning to howl and gibber. Seeing a huge, bright image of himself light up in the sky told him that, on balance, he was probably right to howl and gibber, but probably wrong as far as the direction he was heading was concerned. Taking a deep breath, he turned and headed off towards the inexplicable light show.
Okay, so what's that supposed to prove? Demanded Random.
It was the fact that the image was her father that had startled her, rather than the appearance of the image itself. She had seen her first hologram when she was 2 months old and had been put in it to play. She had seen her most recent one about half an hour ago, playing the march of the Androquantine Starguard. Only that it's no more there or not there than the sheet was, said the bird. It's just the interaction of water from the sky moving in one direction with light at frequencies your senses can detect moving in another. It makes an apparently solid image in your mind, but it's all just images in the mishmash. Here's another one for you.
My mother, said Random.
No, said the bird.
I know my mother when I see her.
The image was of a woman emerging from a spacecraft inside a large grey hangar-like building. She was being escorted by a group of tall, thin, purplish-green creatures. It was definitely Random's mother. Well, almost definitely. Trillian wouldn't have been walking quite so uncertainly in low gravity, or looking around her at a boring old life support environment with quite such a disbelieving look on her face, or carrying such a quaint old camera.
So who is it? Demanded Random.
She is part of the extent of your mother on the probability axis, said the bird guide.
I haven't the faintest idea what you mean,
said Random. Space, time, and probability all have axes along which it is possible to move.
Still don't know, though I think...
No, explain.
I thought you wanted to go home, said the bird.
Explain!
Would you like to see your home?
See it? It was destroyed!
It is discontinuous along the probability axis. Look. Something very strange and wonderful now swam into view in the rain. It was a huge, bluish-greenish globe, misty and cloud-covered, turning with majestic slowness against a black, starry background. Now you see it, said the bird. Now you don't. A little less than 2 miles away now, Arthur Dent stood still in his tracks. He could not believe what he could see, hanging there, shrouded in rain, but brilliant and vividly real against the night sky. The earth. He gasped at the sight of it. Then, at the moment he gasped, it disappeared again. Then it appeared again. Then, and this is the bit that made him give up and stick straws in his hair, it turned into a sausage. Random was also bewildered at the sight of this huge, blue and green and watery and misty sausage hanging above her. And now it was a string of sausages, or rather it was a string of sausages in which many of the sausages were missing. The whole brilliant string turned and span in a bewildering dance in the air, and then gradually slowed, grew insubstantial, and faded into the glistening darkness of the night.
What was that?
Asked Random in a small voice.
A glimpse along the probability axis of a discontinuously probable object.
I see, said Random.
Most objects mutate and change along their axis of probability, but the world of your origin does something slightly different. It lies on what you might call a fault line in the landscape of probability, which means that at many probability coordinates, the whole of it simply ceases to exist. It has an inherent instability, which is typical of anything that lies within what are usually designated the plural sectors. Make sense?
No.
Want to go and see for yourself?
To Earth?
Yes, said the bird.
Is that possible?
The bird guide did not answer at once. It spread its wings and, with an easy grace, ascended into the air and flew out into the rain, which once again was beginning to lighten. It soared ecstatically up into the night sky. Lights flashed around it. Dimensions dithered in its wake. It swooped and turned and looped and turned again, and came at last to rest 2 feet in front of Random's face, its wings beating slowly and silently.
It spoke to her again.
Your universe is vast to you, vast in time, vast in space. That's because of the filters through which you perceive it. But I was built with no filters at all, which means I perceive the mishmash, which contains all possible universes, but which has itself no size at all. For me, anything is possible. I am omniscient and omnipotent, extremely vain, and what is more, I come in a handy self-carrying package. You have to work out how much of the above is true.
A slow smile spread over Random's face.
You bloody little thing, you've been winding me up.
As I said, anything is possible.
Random laughed. Okay, she said. Let's try and go to Earth. Let's go to Earth at some point on its,
probability axis?
Yes, where it hasn't been blown up. Okay, so you're the guide. How do we get a lift?
Reverse engineering, said the bird.
What? Reverse engineering. To me, the flow of time is irrelevant. You decide what you want. I then merely make sure
that it has already happened.
You're joking.
Anything is possible.
Random frowned. You are joking, aren't you? Let me put it another way, said the bird. Reverse engineering enables us to shortcut all the business of waiting for one of the horribly few spaceships that passes through your galactic sector every year or so to make up its mind about whether or not it feels like giving you a lift. You want a lift? A ship arrives and gives you one. The pilot may think he has any one of a million reasons why he has decided to stop and pick you up. The real reason is that I have determined that he will.
This is you being extremely vain, isn't it, little bird? Said Random. The bird was silent.
Okay, said Random. I want a ship to take me to Earth.
Will this one do? It was so silent that Random had not noticed the descending spaceship until it was nearly on top of her. Arthur had noticed it. He was a mile away now and closing. Just after the illuminated sausage display had drawn to its conclusion, he had noticed the faint glimmerings of further lights coming down out of the clouds, and had, to begin with, assumed it to be another piece of flashy Sony Lumiere. It took a moment or so for it to dawn on him that it was an actual spaceship, and a moment or two longer for him to realise that it was dropping directly down to where he assumed his daughter to be. That was when, rain or no rain, old leg injury or no leg injury, darkness or no darkness, he suddenly started really to run. He fell almost immediately, slid and hurt his knee quite badly on a rock. He slithered back up to his feet and tried again. He had a horrible cold feeling that he was about to lose Random forever. Limping and cursing, he ran. He didn't know what it was that had been in the box, but the name on it had been Ford Prefect, and that was the name he cursed as he ran. The ship was one of the sexiest and most beautiful ones that Random had ever seen. It was astounding, sleek, silver, ineffable. If she didn't know better, she would have said it was an RW-6. As it settled silently beside her, she realised that it actually was an RW-6, and she could scarcely breathe for excitement. An RW-6 was the sort of thing you only saw in the sort of magazines that were designed to provoke civil unrest. She was also extremely nervous. The manner and timing of its arrival was deeply unsettling. Either it was the most bizarre coincidence, or something very peculiar and worrying was going on. She waited a little tensely for the ship's hatch to open. Her guide, she thought of it as hers now, was hovering lightly over her right shoulder, its wings barely fluttering. The hatch opened. Just a little dim light escaped. A moment or two passed, and a figure emerged. He stood still for a moment or so, obviously trying to accustom his eyes to the darkness. Then he caught sight of Random standing there, and seemed a little surprised. He started to walk towards her, then suddenly he shouted in surprise and started to run at her. Random was not a good person to take a run at on a dark night when she was feeling a little strung out. She had unconsciously been fingering the rock in her pocket from the moment she saw the craft coming down. Still running, slithering, hurtling and bumping into trees, Arthur saw at last that he was too late. The ship had only been on the ground for about 3 minutes, and now, silently, gracefully, it was rising up above the trees again, turning smoothly in the fine speckle of rain to which the storm had now abated. Climbing, climbing, tipping up its nose, and suddenly, effortlessly, hurtling up through the clouds. Gone. Random was in it. It was impossible for Arthur to know this, but he just went ahead and knew it anyway. She was gone. He had had his stint at being a parent, and could scarcely believe how badly he had done at it. He tried to continue running, but his feet were dragging, his knee was hurting like fury, and he knew that he was too late. He could not conceive that he could feel more wretched and awful than this. But he was wrong. He limped his way at last to the cave where Random had sheltered and opened the box. The ground bore the indentations of the spacecraft that had landed there only minutes before. But of Random there was no sign. He wandered disconsolately into the cave, found the empty box and piles of missing matter pellets strewn around the place. He felt a little cross about that. He tried to teach her about cleaning up after herself. Feeling a bit cross with her about something like that helped him feel less desolate about her leaving. He knew he had no means of finding her. His foot knocked against something unexpected. He bent down to pick it up, and was thoroughly surprised to discover what it was. It was his old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. How did that come to be in the cave? He had never returned to collect it from the scene of the crash. He had not wanted to revisit the crash, and he had not wanted the guide again. He had reckoned he was here, on Lamuella, making sandwiches for good. How did it come to be in the cave? It was active. The words on the cover flashed "Don't panic" at him. He went out of the cave again into the dim and damp moonlight. He sat on a rock to have a look through the old guide, and then discovered it wasn't a rock. It was a person. Chapter 18. Arthur leapt to his feet with a start of fear. It would be hard to say which he was more frightened of, that he might have hurt the person he had inadvertently sat on, or that the person he had inadvertently sat on would hurt him back. There seemed, on inspection, to be little immediate cause for alarm on the second account. Whoever it was he had sat on was unconscious. That will probably go a great deal of the way towards explaining what he was doing lying there. He seemed to be breathing okay, though. Arthur felt his pulse. That was okay as well. He was lying on his side, half curled up. It was so long ago and far away when Arthur had last done first aid that he couldn't really remember what it was he was supposed to do. The first thing he was supposed to do, he remembered, was to have a first aid kit about his person. Damn. Should he roll him on his back or not? Suppose he had any broken bones? Suppose he swallowed his tongue? Suppose he sued him? Who, apart from anything else, was he? At that moment, the unconscious man groaned loudly and rolled himself over. Arthur wondered if he should... He looked at him. He looked at him again. He looked at him again just to make absolutely sure. Despite the fact that he'd been thinking he was feeling about as low as he possibly could, he experienced a terrible sinking feeling. The figure groaned again and slowly opened his eyes. It took him a while to focus, then he blinked and stiffened.
"You," said Ford Prefect.
"You," said Arthur Dent. Ford groaned again. "What do you need to have explained this time?" he said, and closed his eyes in some kind of despair. 5 minutes later, he was sitting up and rubbing the side of his head, where he had quite a large swelling. "Who the hell was that woman?" he said. "Why are we surrounded by squirrels, and what do they want?" "I've been pestered by squirrels all night," said Arthur. "They keep on trying to give me magazines and stuff." Ford frowned. "Really?" he said. "And bits of rag." Ford thought. "Oh," he said, "is this near where your ship crashed?" "Yes," said Arthur. He said it a little tightly. "That's probably it," said Ford. "Can happen. Ship's cabin robots get destroyed. The cybermines that control them survive and start infesting the local wildlife. Can turn a whole ecosystem into some kind of helpless thrashing service industry, handing out hot towels and drinks to passers-by. Should be a law against it. Probably is. Probably also a law against there being a law against it, so everybody can get nice and worked up. Hey-ho. What did you say?" "I said," said Arthur, "and the woman is my daughter." Ford stopped rubbing his head.
"Say that one more time."
"I said," said Arthur huffily, "the woman is my daughter." "I didn't know," said Ford, "that you had a daughter." "Well, there's probably a lot you don't know about me," said Arthur. "Come to mention it, there's probably a lot I don't know about me either." "Well, well, well," said Ford, "when did this happen?"
"I'm not quite sure."
"Well, that sounds like more familiar territory," said Ford. "Is there a mother involved?"
"Trillion," said Arthur.
"Trillion? I didn't think that..." "No. Look, it's a bit embarrassing."
"I remember she told me once she had a kid," said Ford, "but only sort of in passing. I'm in touch with her from time to time. Never seen her with the kid."
Arthur said nothing. Ford started to feel the side of his head again in some bemusement.
"Are you sure this was your daughter?" he said.
"Tell me what happened," said Arthur.
"Phew! Long story. I was coming to pick up this parcel I'd sent myself here, care of you." Well, what was all that about?" said Arthur.
"I think it may be something unimaginably dangerous."
"And you sent it to me?" protested Arthur.
"Safest place I could think of. I thought I could rely on you to be absolutely boring and not open it. Anyway, coming in at night, I couldn't find this village place. I was going by pretty basic information. I couldn't find any signal of any kind. I guess you don't have signals and stuff here."
"That's what I like about it," said Arthur.
"Then I did pick up a faint signal from your old copy of the guide, so I homed in on that, thinking that would take me to you. I found I'd landed in some kind of wood, couldn't figure out what was going on. I get out and then see this woman standing there. I go up to say hello, then suddenly see that she's got this thing."
"What thing?" said Arthur.
"The thing I sent you, the new guide, the bird thing. You were meant to keep it safe, you idiot, but this woman had the thing right there by her shoulder. I ran forward and she hit me with a rock."
"I see," said Arthur. "What did you do?"
"Well, I fell over, of course. I was very badly hurt. She and the bird started to make off towards my ship, and when I say my ship, I mean an RW6.
"A what?"
"An RW6, for Zark's sake. I've got this great relationship going now between my credit card and the guide's central computer. You would not believe that ship, Arthur. It's..."
"So an RW6 is a spaceship, then?"
"Yes, it's..." "Oh, never mind. Look, just get some kind of grip, will you, Arthur? Or at least get some kind of catalogue." At this point, I was very worried, and I think semi-concussed. I was down on my knees and bleeding profusely, so I did the only thing I could think of, which was to beg. I said, "Please, for Zark's sake, don't take my ship, and don't leave me stranded in the middle of some primitive Zarking forest with no medical help and a head injury. I could be in serious trouble, and so could she."
"What did she say?"
"She hit me on the head with a rock again."
"I think I can confirm that that was my daughter."
"Ah, sweet kid."
You have to get to know her, said Arthur. Oh, she eases up, does she?
No, said Arthur, but you get a better sense of when to duck.
Ford held his head and tried to see straight. The sky was beginning to lighten in the west, which is where the sun rose. Arthur didn't particularly want to see it. The last thing he wanted after a hellish night like this one was some blasted day coming along and barging about the place.
What are you doing in a place like this, Arthur? Demanded Ford.
Well, said Arthur, making sandwiches mostly.
What?
I am, probably was, the sandwich maker for a small tribe. It was a bit embarrassing, really. When I first arrived, that is, when they rescued me from the wreckage of this super-high-technology spacecraft which had crashed on their planet. They were very nice to me, and I thought I should help them out a bit. You know, I'm an educated chap from a high-technology culture. I could show them a thing or two. And, of course, I couldn't. I haven't got the faintest idea, when it comes down to it, of how anything actually works. I don't mean, like, video recorders. I mean, nobody knows how to work those. I mean, just something like a pen or an artesian well or something. Not the foggiest. I couldn't help at all. One day I got glum and made myself a sandwich. That suddenly got them all excited. They'd never seen one before. It was just an idea that had never occurred to them, and I happened to quite like making sandwiches, so it all sort of developed from there.
And you enjoyed that? Said Ford.
Well, yes, I think I sort of did, really. Getting a good set of knives, you know, that sort of thing.
You didn't, for instance, said Ford, find it mind-witheringly, explosively, astoundingly, blisteringly dull?
Well, no, not as such, not actually blisteringly.
Odd, I would, said Ford.
Well, I suppose we have a different outlook.
Yes, like the picker birds.
Ford had no idea what he was talking about and couldn't be bothered to ask. Instead, he said, so how the hell do we get out of this place?
Well, I think the simplest way from here is just to follow the way down the valley to the plains, probably take an hour, and then walk around from there. I don't think I could face going back up and over the way I came.
Walk round where from there?
Well, back to the village, I suppose.
Arthur sighed a little forlornly.
I don't want to go to any blasted village, snapped Ford. We've got to get out of here.
Where? How? Said Arthur.
I don't know. You tell me. You live here. There must be some way off this zarking planet.
I don't know, said Arthur. What do you usually do? Sit around and wait for a passing spacecraft, I suppose.
Oh, yes? And how many spacecraft have visited the zark-forsaken little flea pit recently?
Well, a few years ago there was mine that crashed here by mistake, then there was a trillion, then the parcel delivery, and now you, and...
Yes, but apart from the usual suspects...
Well, I think pretty much none, so far as I know. Pretty quiet around here.
As if deliberately to prove him wrong, there was a long, low, distant roll of thunder.
Ford leapt to his feet fretfully, and started pacing backwards and forwards in the feeble, painful light of the early dawn, which lay streaked across the sky as if someone had dragged a piece of liver across it.
"You don't understand how important this is," he said.
"What? You mean my daughter out there all alone in the galaxy? You think I don't?"
"Can we feel sorry for the galaxy later?" said Ford. "This is very, very serious indeed. The guide has been taken over. It's been bought out."
Arthur leapt up.
"Oh, very serious," he shouted. "Please fill me in straight away on some corporate publishing politics. I can't tell you how much has been on my mind of late."
"You don't understand," said Ford. "There's a whole new guide."
"Oh," shouted Arthur again. Oh, I'm incoherent with excitement. I can hardly wait for it to come out to find out which are the most exciting spaceports to get bored hanging about in some globular cluster I've never heard of. Please can we rush to a store that's got it right this very instant?"
Ford narrowed his eyes. "This is that thing you call sarcasm, isn't it?"
"Do you know," bellowed Arthur, "I think it is. I really think it might just be a crazy little thing called sarcasm seeping in at the edges of my manner of speech. Ford, I have had a fucking bad night. Will you please try and take that into account while you consider what fascinating bits of badger-sputumly inconsequential trivia to assail me with next?"
"Try to rest," said Ford. "I need to think."
"Why do you need to think? Can't we just sit and go with our lips for a bit? Couldn't we just... dribble gently and loll a little bit to the left for a few minutes? I can't stand it, Ford. I can't stand all this thinking and trying to work things out anymore. You may think that I'm just standing here barking."
"Hadn't occurred to me, in fact."
"But I mean it. What is the point? We assume that every time we do anything, we know what the consequences will be, i.e. more or less what we intend them to be. This is not only not always correct, it is wildly, crazily, stupidly, cross-eyed, blithering, insectly wrong."
"Which is exactly my point," said Ford.
"Thank you,"
said Arthur, sitting down again.
"What?
Temporal reverse engineering."
Arthur put his head in his hands and shook it gently from side to side. "Is there any humane way," he moaned, "in which I can prevent you from telling me what temporary reverse bloody what's-iting is?"
No, said Ford, because your daughter is caught up in the middle of it, and it is deadly, deadly serious.
Thunder rolled in the pause. All right, said Arthur, tell me.
I leapt out of a high-rise office window, said Ford.
This cheered Arthur up.
Oh, he said, why don't you do it again?
I did.
Hmm, said Arthur, disappointed. Obviously no good came of it.
The first time, said Ford, I managed to save myself by the most astonishing and, I say this in all modesty, fabulous piece of ingenious, quick-thinking agility, fancy footwork and self-sacrifice.
What was the self-sacrifice, said Arthur?
I jettisoned half of a much-loved and, I think, irreplaceable pair of shoes.
Why was that self-sacrifice?
Because they were mine, said Ford crossly.
I think we have different value systems, said Arthur.
Well, mine's better, said Ford.
Well, that's according to your...
Oh, never mind.
So having saved yourself very cleverly once, you very sensibly went and jumped again. Please don't tell me why. Just tell me what happened, if you must.
I fell straight into the open cockpit of a passing jet town car, whose pilot had just accidentally pushed the eject button when he meant only to change tracks on the stereo. Now, even I couldn't think that that was particularly clever of me.
Now, I don't know, said Arthur wearily. I expect he probably sneaked into his jet car the previous night and set the pilot's least favourite track to play or something.
No, I didn't, said Ford. Just checking.
Though, oddly enough, somebody else did. And this is the nub. You could trace the chain and branches of crucial events and coincidences back and back. Turned out, the new guide had done it. That bird.
What bird? Said Arthur.
You haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, it's a lethal little thing. Looks pretty, talks big, collapses waveform selectively at will.
What does that mean?
Temporal reverse engineering.
Oh, said Arthur.
Oh, yes.
The question is, who is it really doing it for?
I've actually got a sandwich in my pocket, said Arthur Delving. Would you like a bit?
Yeah, okay.
It's a bit squished and sodden, I'm afraid.
Never mind.
They munched for a bit.
It's quite good, in fact, said Ford. What's the meat in it?
Perfectly normal beast, said Arthur.
Ah, not come across that one.
So the question is, Ford continued, who is the bird really doing it for? What's the real game here?
Mmm, et Arthur.
When I found the bird, continued Ford, which I did by a series of coincidences that are interesting in themselves, it put on the most fantastic multidimensional display of pyrotechnics I've ever seen. It then said that it would put its services at my disposal in my universe. I said thanks, but no thanks. It said that it would do it anyway, whether I liked it or not. I said just try it, and it said that it would, and indeed already had done. I said we'd see about that, and it said that we would. That's when I decided to pack the thing up and get it out of there. So I sent it to you for safety.
Oh, yes, said Arthur. Whose?
Never you mind, said Ford. Then, what with one thing and another, I thought it prudent to jump out of the window again, being fresh out of other options at the time. Luckily for me, the jet car was there, otherwise I would have had to fall back on ingenious, quick-thinking agility, maybe another shoe or, failing all else, the ground. But it meant that, whether I liked it or not, the guide was, well, working for me, and that was deeply worrying.
Why?
Because if you've got the guide, you think that you are the one it's working for. Everything went swimmingly smoothly for me from then on, up to the very moment that I came up against the totty with the rock. Then, bang, I'm history, I'm out of the loop.
Are you referring to my daughter?
As politely as I can, said Ford. She's the next one in the chain who will think that everything is going fabulously for her. She can beat whoever she likes around the head with bits of the landscape. Everything will just swim for her until she's done whatever she's supposed to do, and then it'll be all up for her too. It's reverse temporal engineering, and clearly nobody understood what was being unleashed.
Like me, for instance, said Arthur.
What? Oh, wake up, Arthur. Look, let me try it again. The new guide came out of the research labs. It made use of this new technology of unfiltered perception. Do you know what that means?
Look, I've been making sandwiches for Bob's sake, said Arthur.
Who's Bob?
Never mind, just carry on.
Unfiltered perception, said Ford, means it perceives everything. Got that? I don't perceive everything, you don't perceive everything, we have filters. The new guide doesn't have any sense filters, it perceives everything. It wasn't a complicated technological idea, it was just a question of leaving a bit out. Got it?
Why don't I just say that I've got it, said Arthur, and then you can carry on regardless.
Right. Now, because the bird can perceive every possible universe, it is present in every possible universe, yes?
Yes-ish.
So what happens is the bozos in the marketing and accounting department say, oh, that sounds good. Doesn't that mean we only have to make one of them and then sell it an infinite number of times? Don't squint at me like that, Arthur. This is how accountants think. Well, it's quite clever, isn't it? No, it's fantastically stupid. Look, the machine's only a little guide. It's got some quite clever cyber technology in it, but because it has unfiltered perception, any smallest move it makes has the power of a virus. It can propagate throughout space, time, and a million other dimensions. Anything can be focused anywhere in any of the universes that you and I move in. Its power is recursive. Think of a computer program. Somewhere there is one key instruction, and everything else is just functions calling themselves or brackets billowing out endlessly through an infinite address space. What happens when the brackets collapse? What's the final end if? Is any of this making sense, Arthur? Sorry, I was nodding off for a moment. Something about the universe, yes? Something about the universe, yes, said Ford wearily. He sat down again. All right, he said, think about this. You know who I think I saw at the guide offices? Vogons. Ah, I see I've said a word you understand at last. Arthur leapt to his feet. That noise, he said. What noise? The thunder. What about it? It isn't thunder. It's the spring migration of the perfectly normal beasts. It started. What are these animals you keep on about? I don't keep on about them. I just put bits of them in sandwiches. Why are they called perfectly normal beasts? Said Ford. Arthur told him. It wasn't often that Arthur had the pleasure of seeing Ford's eyes open wide with astonishment. Chapter 19. It was a sight that Arthur never quite got used to or tired of. He and Ford had tracked their way swiftly along the side of the small river that flowed down along the bed of the valley, and when at last they reached the margin of the plains, they pulled themselves up into the branches of a large tree to get a better view of one of the stranger and more wonderful visions that the galaxy has to offer. The great thunderous herd of thousand upon thousand of perfectly normal beasts was sweeping in magnificent array across the Anhondo Plain. In the early pale light of the morning, as the great animals charged through the fine steam of the sweat of their bodies mingled with the muddy mist churned up by their pounding hooves, their appearance seemed a little unreal and ghostly anyway, but what was heart-stopping about them was where they came from and where they went to, which appeared to be simply nowhere. They formed a solid, charging phalanx, roughly 100 yards wide and half a mile long. The phalanx never moved, except that it exhibited a slight gradual drift sideways and backwards for the 8 or 9 days that it regularly appeared for. But though the phalanx stayed more or less constant, the great beasts of which it was composed charged steadily at upwards of 20 miles an hour, appearing suddenly from thin air at one end of the plain and disappearing equally abruptly at the other end. No one knew where they came from. No one knew where they went. They were so important to the lives of the Lamuellans, it was almost as if nobody liked to ask. Old Thrashbark had said on one occasion that sometimes if you received an answer, the question might be taken away. Some of the villagers had privately said that this was the only properly wise thing that they'd ever heard Thrashbark say, and after a short debate on the matter, had put it down to chance.
End of side 4.